Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. This is part 15 of a Grand Canyon oral history with Nancy Mulady Meacham, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Tom.
Great, good to hear it. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. Nancy, when we wrapped up our last interview, you mentioned that in 2010, you got a Fulbright scholarship. Can you tell me more about that?
I can. And let me precede that a little bit with, since I left the National Park Service as an employee in 2003, that I actually continue on in other professional things, including working at Sequoia National Park as a seasonal, 2004, 5, and 6, as a naturalist. And I love being a seasonal there.
Let's back up.
Okay.
So in Sequoia in the summer, in 2003, now you hadn't been to Sequoia in quite a while. Is that right?
Well, actually, I had been there almost every single year to go backpacking with a friend of mine, Marianne Carlton.
Okay.
So all of us who work with the National Park Service develop what we call as a heart park. My husband, Kent's, is Yellowstone. Mine is Sequoia. So you like to go back to your heart park, the one that means the most to you, or maybe it was your first park and it never left you.
Hmm.
And being a naturalist, a seasonal naturalist, I went back to shared housing as a married woman. I left my husband to work at the Grand Canyon. And, you know, the shared bathroom, but and working in a regular schedule as giving walks, talks, and evening programs. And I was just delighted to do that in a place that I loved. And it was kind of torn because, you know, you leave your dogs and your husband and your family at home, but then you're here in this beautiful place with friends that I knew and made new friends, too. In fact, it was a person at Grand Canyon who transferred to Sequoia National Park who hired me. And,
oh, wow.
Richard Ullman.
Oh, wow.
L-L-M-A-N. And
he's a great guy. What can you tell me about Richard?
Richard is a wonderful human being. And to give you an insight as to his personality, which is up almost all the time, and Mr. Enthusiasm, it won't surprise you to know that he worked at Disneyland.
Got it.
As a cast member. So that's where his personality, I'm sure, shined. But he had several philosophies. Was if you find something wrong, fix it. Don't pass it on to somebody else to fix it.
Nice.
You know, take care of it right away. He was one of those people that took care of the people instead of the operation. And when he found out that I was interested in coming back to Lodgepole as a seasonal when I could not come back in protection at the Grand Canyon, he said, by all means, I will hire you. Come back. And
oh,
so
wow.
I did. And I came back 3 seasons in a row. And so it was just a delightful thing. And Richard later got married and became a ranger at Petrified Forest. And he had a child. And I got to see him at Chuck Waller's retirement a few years ago. So it's fun when you know people in the Park Service and you reconnect with them. Just as a huge aside, there was a ranger at the North Rim at the Grand Canyon that I worked with, who went to Katmai, and so Kent and I went up to Katmai to visit them, and that was another way to visit friends and see another national park. So it's this great big labyrinth of connections that you can make. I have a friend down at Joshua Tree, Marker Marshall, who used to be at the Grand Canyon, that I went down and visited her after she transferred there. So there's all these wonderful opportunities, because most of us take busman holidays, meaning we go to why we're in the national parks. And I'll talk about it a little bit more when we talk about what it takes to be a park ranger or some of the life as a park ranger. But when I went back to Sequoia 2004, 5, and 6, at the end of the season, I took time to walk the John Muir Trail and do part of the Pacific Crest Trail and to backpack in a place that I just love to do, to backpack. And then
what were the changes that you saw when you came back in 2004? Yeah, because you've been there for 30 years?
Oh, I had I had been there since 1979,
mm-hmm.
and I worked there until 1990, and then I would go back every year to go backpacking. And in that time, I saw lots of changes, and the changes had to do on twofold, one on the government side and one on the visitor side.
Okay.
And the government side was, we don't have the money to do the infrastructure to maintain these buildings, so instead of two people for a house, you have to have three people for a house of seasonal housing. And we don't have the money to hire as many people. So over time, instead of hiring national park rangers to be naturalists, they began giving programming to the concessions of the park.
The oh, wow.
non-uniformed people were starting to give walks and talks and hold programs. And now you go to Sequoia today, and I'll be going back there twice this year to go backpacking. You'll see somebody standing at the tree, somebody maybe giving an evening program, and not much else. And then the concession will have other activities. It's pretty stark. And on the other hand, the other huge change that came is you recall the campfire started in the 1930s with big bonfires and people bringing their chairs and sitting around it. And then in the time that I was a naturalist at Sequoia, I was trained by one of those 1950s rangers that was trained by the 1930s rangers. And so we gave traditional evening programs where we got people to sing and do fun little stuff. And then we showed them maybe a PowerPoint presentation or we did a lapis dazzle slide program.
Mm.
PowerPoint, they weren't even laptops then.
Right.
But then RVs started to come. People began to have entertainment in their RVs. And rather than come to evening programs, they stayed at home and watched their television.
Oh, wow.
There was no reception. So we used to fill the Lodgepole Amphitheater, 400 people. And if you got 35 or 40 at an evening program on a Saturday, that was saying something.
Wow.
As when I went back in the aughts, the 4, 5, and 6. So it was very dramatic as people could bring their own entertainment. They didn't want to go out and go to an evening program anymore. And also the demographics changed. But I remember one time, I think it was 2004, I also had a program, a non-electronic program called Songs and Stories, where I made little booklets with traditional songs like She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain and things like that, and hand them out to the groups. I would play the guitar, and in between, while they caught their breath, I would tell a story with the theme of being people or exploration or something. And at the end of one of these small little intimate groups that I held at Wuxachee, which was the new hotel that they had built in an area north of Lodgepole to replace the giant forest that they had returned to nature, I had a family who were originally from India and had little kids that were born and were being raised in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably 6, 7, 8, 9. And the lady came up to me and said, oh, we're so glad we did this because now we feel like Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
cool.
Singing American-type stories and doing a traditional national park thing.
Yeah.
But then you have people who come and they just want to walk with their family group of, you know, 15, you know, because a lot of Hispanic families come up in groups and stuff and they want to go and walk up the trail on their own pace without necessarily having somebody guide them.
Right.
But the demographics changed, what they wanted to do changed, and the government and the National Park Service need to evolve with that, which some are doing, but it's very different. And some people will say, well, as I do the golden age when people came to listen to what you had to say, I'm not necessarily what you wanted them to do. As a result, though, we do have more problems because the message of what national parks are was not getting out there, especially safety messages. Down in the foothills of Sequoia National Park, every year we'll have drownings because we're trying to tell people in multiple languages, don't go in this water. It, you know, just like going to Colorado, it's dangerous, it's fast, it's
mm-hmm.
da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
And so we now have signs in multiple languages just for safety reasons.
This is really fascinating because we think about the population of the country increasing and the budget of the Park Service not being able to keep up. Again, housing is an issue. And, you know, you cut back on staff and cut back on staff while population visitation increases. The whole concept of the national parks suddenly becomes at risk.
It does. And then when Kent retired, my husband in 2008, Kent Meacham, M-E-C-H-A-M, in 2007, we knew, because I followed him and I didn't mind doing that, that the deal was we got to come back to my beloved Sierra Nevada. So we went to Northern California, in a little town called Arnold, and we knew when Kent was retired that we may not get a loan, because when you pay rent and utilities on government housing, you don't get to save a lot of money. So we got our loan while he was still working in 2007, a 30-year loan to buy a house, which we did in the town of Arnold. Then he retired the next year, 2008, where we moved here. And I worked as a ski patrol medic for several years at the Bear Valley and continue my work as an emergency room nurse.
Hey, Nancy, per diem. Mm-hmm. Did the loan that you guys got, was that part of the National Park Service housing program?
No, because we weren't working with or for the national parks. That was just a civilian going to a bank and doing all that kind of thing. The housing with the National Park Service changed over time. When I was employed there, there were very few benefits, if any, for seasonals. You were in seasonal housing. You shared it with somebody. When I was in Cabin 85, for instance, it was a one-bedroom, one-kitchen, and initially didn't have a bathroom, but they later added a bathroom that I told that we lost during the Coalinga earthquake, but they put it back on again. And then there were two porches that were screened in. So I loved to sleep outside, so I always slept out on the east porch, screened in, and when I would come early in the season, it would snow would come through the screen on me or whatever, and then the roommates would either be in the bedroom or be on the west porch. So there was a time when there were three people in some of these cabins that I shared.
I was thinking about there's a program that the Park Service has to help people who buy a house in a community near their park.
That didn't exist initially. So what that program is you are a permanent person.
Yep.
And what happens is national parks were starting to get rid of housing for rangers inside of the parks themselves.
Okay.
Not just rangers, but people who work for the national parks. They wanted to decrease the population inside. So if you were at Grand Canyon and you worked in human resources, they decided, except for maybe one person, the other 14 worked at Flagstaff.
Okay.
And so they had to have a place to live. And when you're in a national park, there is a house usually for you to bid on and live in and pay rent and utilities. If you're given a place, there is a program, and not having taken advantage of it, I can only give you a light description of it, where you would buy your own house based upon your own ability to buy a house. But then let's say you applied for a working in Yellowstone National Park. And so you would find a house in Yellowstone National Park. Often you would find the ranger who had left and maybe buy their house. And then you would then sell your house and move up. If by the time you had to go, you hadn't sold your house, there was a program where the U.S. government would buy your house for you to enable you to make that move. But it was kind of complex. I don't know much about it. We never took advantage of it because when you're in emergency services, you always live in the park because you had required housing. You didn't have a choice.
Got it.
Which is why we never owned a home, because we never had an opportunity to live, say, in Flagstaff, own a home, and then commute. I know a naturalist, Chuck Waller, he and his wife bought a condo, and he would commute up and back from Flagstaff because he wasn't required to be in the park toward the end of his career.
Okay, and that makes sense. So then you guys had to go to a bank and show, look, I'm retiring from federal service.
No, you don't use the word retire. Nope.
Really?
I'm gainfully employed.
Right.
I am worth giving a loan to buy a house. If you said you retired, they're going, well, maybe your income's going to cut in half and you wouldn't be a good risk.
Oh, yeah, but wouldn't they say, gee, you know, you're a federal employee, you're going to have retirement benefits and
they don't know anything about that.
Really?
The banks don't care about that.
Oh, interesting.
So in 2007, when Kent was still employed,
mm-hmm.
and I was working as emergency room nurse, and I was also doing semester C, which I'll explain in a moment. So we went to a bank, and we got a loan based upon his current income, because when you retire, you don't make the money you make
right.
when you're working full-time.
Got it.
So he's still employed, and we want money to buy this house in Arnold, California, to move there someday.
Okay.
And it just happened to be a year later that we moved there.
Okay.
But we owned the house a year before. We would come and visit it a couple times before we actually moved there a year later to live in it.
Okay.
And so we decided to do that because there was always a chance that they would say, I'm only partially employed, and I don't have a pension because I won't get my pension until I'm 65. And then Kent, he's on a pension making half of what he made. Why should we give you a 30-year loan?
Got it.
So we didn't want to have that obstacle, so we did it a year before. And we got a great mortgage, and we're still we're halfway through our 30 mortgage or something like that, I think. And so down in 2007, it was a big year for me in terms of I went to Europe and I hiked the Haut route, which is 100 kilometers from Chamonix to Zermatt by myself, solo. You know, my knee was healed and I'm doing great things. I went to Ireland and visited my family there. And one of the reasons I burst out and did this is my dog of so many years, Shannon, that Kent and I had had for 13 years, had passed away. So I had time I felt that I could leave because she wasn't old and going to be dying while I was gone. So I did a bunch of stuff and applied for and received a job as a professor of biology out of the University of Virginia to teach at Semester at Sea for a semester, 100 days. So you get on this boat that's 592 feet long.
And wow.
Motor vessel. It has 1,000 people on it, 700 of which are students,
wow.
25 professors. And I'm paid to teach biology around the world. And I prepared classes. When we were on the ocean or on the water, we'd have classes every single day, and then we went to 11 different ports, and then I would lead field trips. And the field trips weren't necessarily for just the students in my four classes, but it was open to anyone, including lifelong learners and somebody who's a sociology major. So, for instance, when I was in Egypt, I led a field trip through the pyramids, and when I was at the in Istanbul or Constantinople, I led a ecology field trip to the Black Sea, and I didn't have a field trip in Japan, so I latched on to one with the history professor, and we went, because you always have to have two professors, one who leads it and one who's just there as a sort of a, to help everybody else out, and so I latched on as a second professor for the history program to Hiroshima.
Wow.
And so it was just an incredible opportunity, and I got to see a lot of places you can't go now. I went to Egypt. You know, I went to Spain and led a ecology field trip in Doñana National Park, which you could do. But we went to China, Qingdao. We went to the Hong Kong, which you can't do now, and went to many, many different places. And it was just outstanding. And Croatia, and it was amazing.
How long were you at sea?
Turkey, 100 days.
And did you go? Was that all the way around the world, or was that where?
All the way around the world.
Wow.
Absolutely. We left California, Ensenada, because there's an act called the Jones Act, which means a ship of the can't leave United States that's not a United States flag and land in the United States within the same calendar year. It's weird.
Hmm.
So everybody boarded in Ensenada because it was, I forget, it was Bahama flag or something. That's just to save money.
Huh.
So we started there, and we went to Hawaii, then we went to Japan, then we went to China and Hong Kong, India, Cambodia, Vietnam, Turkey, Egypt, Spain, Croatia. I'm missing something, but you get the idea.
So through the Suez Canal and then into the Mediterranean.
Yeah, we went through the Suez Canal. We were attacked by pirates in the Malacca Strait past Singapore.
Wait. What?
They had a 50-millimeter gun on the front of their boat.
What did you do?
Well, before we got there, the crew would do what they called Captain Morgan drills. And do you know what Captain Morgan represents?
No.
If you look on a bottle of scotch, and I don't drink, but I know this, he's a pirate.
Okay.
So Captain Morgan drills mean that there were pirates. So they would go to the crew would then go to the ship. Everybody else would go to the middle of the ship. And they would take the fire hoses and they would spray them down the side of the ship so that anybody who tried to board would hopefully get pushed off by the stream of the hose.
Okay.
But if they have automatic fires, they can kill these people with the hoses. And so So the best answer, and the captain explained this to all of us at a huge meeting, that our best defense is our speed, because we could go 30 knots and those little boats maybe only 25 knots.
Wow.
So we're going through the Malacca Straits. They called it Captain Morgan, not a drill. And before we went out, we could see the boats out in front. And the problem with this is because they can't keep up with this, sometimes two boats would put a rope across and spread from each other. So when the bow of the ship went through, it would push the rope and bring the boats to the pirate ship
alongside
the side of the ship.
What a clever idea.
That way.
Okay.
Very clever. So this one had a 50 millimeter cannon on the front of it. And so, and I have pictures of it. And so the captain just said, you know, basically hang on to your hats, Captain Morgan. And we just zipped through the Malacca Straits, and they didn't fire on us. And they tried to catch up with us, but they didn't.
Wow.
So it was very exciting times and really, really interesting for the students, you know. And one of the things I taught, you know, is we did field trips in India, and I several of my students were doing special programs, and so they were assigned, and we knew this ahead of time, to some of Mother Teresa's orphanages.
Mm.
And I taught them pediatric neonatal nursing skills, and one of the nurses, one of the students, was taking care of a baby, and they had taken these toys and coloring books and stuff. And when I went and checked on them every day, they said, these are lousy. Most of these kids are blind and don't have arms and don't have legs. We need diapers. We need chocolate. You know, I gave a piece of chocolate to a baby, and they said it was the first time it ever laughed.
Wow.
So they got a real world look at things. And then one of my students came and told me, she said, I think I did something good today. And I said, what? She goes, you know how you told me to feel the top of a baby's head where the soft spot is, the fontanelle, and if it's sunken, they're dehydrated, and if it's swollen, they're septic and have an infection? She goes, this baby had a crater in its head, and I took it to the nurse, to the nuns, and they said, oh, my goodness. So they took it to the hospital and rehydrated the baby and saved its life.
Wow.
And they said, you saved this life because you have that skill.
Mm-hmm.
And she was of a wealthy family, this particular student. She made arrangements to come back and work the orphanage in years.
Cool.
But they also saw other things. There were public restrooms that nobody went into. I'm talking about the women in Chennai, India. They had long skirts because all they had to do was squat on the sidewalk to urinate or defecate,
mm-hmm.
and stand up and move on. So really the whole place smelled like a cesspool.
Mm.
And the reason they didn't do that is if they went into the public restrooms, they would probably be raped there.
Mm.
So the students got a real world look at things. And when you go to the train station and you're coming back from a trip to Agra or Delhi or something, and you have to walk over 10,000 people just to get out the door because that people don't have homes. That's where
right.
they're sleeping. But and then you go to a place like Egypt, and there's no beggars.
Hmm.
There's nobody on the streets because in Islam, it is wrong to allow anybody to be without.
Right.
And so Islam and to be a Muslim, they got to see that there was a side other than being a terrorist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it was really, really important. So, and I learned that when I did my Fulbright scholarship, which just would open this thing that we've been so diverted from. Because I had a student in one of my classes who was actually an administrator in Russia who had married a woman from Kazakhstan who was Muslim, and he converted.
Hmm.
And I asked him about, you know, the prejudice against Islam. And he says, it isn't really happening here. And I said, what does Islam preach about killing a person? It says, when you kill a person, you kill the world. It is absolutely forbidden in Islam to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you get what it is to be a true Muslim versus somebody who is a jihadist.
Nice.
So it was a real eye-opener.
Hmm.
So anyway, in 2007, for Virginia semester at the University of Virginia, I went around the world and just had a wonderful time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Were you tempted to do that again?
Yes, they asked if I wanted to do it again, but to be away from home for 4 months is a long time.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of work. You are on all the time.
Right.
It's very exhausting because when students go off the ship and come back on the ship, you know, you're walking with them, you're guiding them. There's very little time. When I knew I had, when I went to Thailand and we took them to a place where we rode elephants and all that kind of stuff, I had 2 days where I didn't have to lead anything or do anything. So I went to this little island, and I went scuba diving,
mm-hmm.
and I came back, and apparently I wasn't as secretive as I thought, because about 10 o'clock at nighttime. So a bunch of students came knocking on my door and said, Doc Nancy, somebody at the beach is unconscious. They need you. So they knew I was a medical professional. I didn't even know they knew I was there.
Hmm.
They had seen me but had left me alone, you know. So we ran down, and somebody had gotten so drunk they were, like, aspirating their vomit, and we did left lateral, and we called the facilities, and I showed them how to take care of the patient and all that stuff. And so we were good. And they weren't even my students. They just knew me from the ship.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, and so it was an incredible opportunity, and I thought it was a wonderful time to show my skills, because I taught anatomy and physiology and people pathology in world medicine. I taught conservation of the world, the natural history of the earth, and I taught some special global interest classes, and plus all of these field trips. And so it was a great opportunity. And I know I had a good reputation, because at the end of the class, of the course, right before we're getting back to the United States, they had an auction, and I had for each class a huge binder with each class set of PowerPoint slides in it, so they could, if they couldn't take their notes fast enough, there it was in the book.
Hmm.
And I donated those to the auction. And they came into a faculty meeting we had. She said, "You need to come down here. Your books are going for an astronomical amount of money, and they're bidding right and left on them." So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, that's very neat.
So that went really nice.
Cool.
Yeah. And then the next year, 2008, we moved to Arnold, California. And as I said, I worked part-time as a per diem as an ER nurse. In the wintertime, I worked as a ski patrol medic, and became a member of the California Emergency Response Team, which I still am a member of. And I've worked, in fact, Friday I worked my 24th clinic giving COVID vaccinations. I've also worked flu clinics in the past.
Okay.
And then with my semester at sea behind me, I received, and I think it was through them, I received a letter saying, this is the Department of State of the United States, got it through my university email at Northern Arizona University, which I should say have done a wonderful thing for me. When I was teaching part-time at NAU, and I went to them and said, "I'm leaving, we're going to California," and they said, "Would you like to stay on as an adjunct professor?"
Mm.
And I said, "I would love it, because it would benefit them and benefit me to have an association." So anytime I published a paper, it was because I was a professor at NAU. When I went on my Fulbright scholarship, I did it as a professor at NAU.
Nice.
And when I went for University of Virginia, I did it at NAU. But they also gave me the chutzpah or whatever it is, saying I'm associated with the university. So it worked both ways really well.
Yeah, great.
So through NAU, I got an inquiry, "Would you like to inquire to be a Fulbright scholar?"
Hmm.
And I said, "The two places we have open are Mongolia and Russia." And I said, "Oh, gosh, Mongolia, I'd love to do that." And my husband, Kent, said, "Please don't go to Mongolia." I said, "Well, okay. How Russia?" And then I don't think he counted on me wanting to not go into a city, be Siberia. And I said, if I go, it would be Siberia. And so I made a proposal to research protected areas to teach at Grinnell Altai State University. I made a contact there. They said, "We would love to have you here. We would sponsor you."
What's the name of the university?
Grinnell, G-U-R-O-N-O, Altaisk State, S-T-A-T-E, University. And the Russian Federation uses the word, they have a different word for it, of course, in Russia, but they use the word state to mean a federal area. And so I contacted them because I did not want to be in a city. I didn't want to be in St. Petersburg. I didn't want to be in Moscow. I didn't want to be in Novosibirsk or Irkutsk. I wanted to be in Siberia.
Hmm.
Later on, after this year, I was so successful, they invited me back to give talks to new Fulbright scholars and to evaluate people who were applying. For 3 years, I was on the committee that picked Fulbright scholars.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very neat association for 4 years through the State Department. But I was fortunate enough to be selected. You go back to Washington, D.C., you learn what's expected to you. And basically, because we're representing the State Department,
mm-hmm.
a big part of it is being a professor and being able to do research in the field and to teach. but you're also an ambassador. So you learn, if you didn't have people skills already, you learn what to do and what not to do, how to respond to things. And so it's just as a little mini example. When I was first doing my research and my Russian wasn't up to snuff, I had a student go with me to do translations. And we stayed at the place, and the lady wanted to charge more than I was initially quoted. And my student went into what I call her Russian mode. And the Russian mode is very aggressive, very loud, very attack mode. And I said, Ichinicha, you know, excuse me. And I pulled her away, and I spoke to her, and I said, Valia, Valentina, Valia, I said, when you speak, you're speaking for me. You are representing me. Have you ever heard me yell? No. Have you ever heard me say bad words, because I knew bad words in Russian? And I said, no. And I said, haven't I always been the diplomat and been very kind and tried to work out the problem? She says, yes. And I said, you are me when you talk for me. And so she learned to be a diplomat, too. And we worked it out.
Nice.
But but these are the things that, if you do not already do it, these are the things the State Department says this is what you must do. Because there have been State Department appointees that have been brought home in the past. Because things haven't worked out. But there's two levels of Fulbright scholarship. One is for professors who do the scholars. You do research, you do teaching, or you do both. I did both. There's also student Fulbrighters. And student Fulbrighters are those who are already in school as students who apply, who show a lot of promise. There's a whole chunk of students who go to teach English as a second language in a country, kind of like not the Peace Corps, but similar to it, but it's a scholarly level. But they aren't teaching a topic so much as they're teaching a language. Or there are cases where they are going to go do some research on something under a professor that they want to study under. But I was on the professor level, so I was a Fulbright scholar as opposed to a Fulbright student.
Right, right.
And so knowing that I got selected, I started preparing for my classes. I taught, a pathology class. I taught a class in evolution. So I got a whole bunch of copies of The Origin of Species by Darwin. I taught a conservation class. And I also got the American Astronomical Society to donate 24 Galileo scopes. And I was going to teach to the community of Gorno-Altaysk, not just the introduction to astronomy, and then donate those to them. And it was very successful. My first meeting with the community, we had over 100 people. And so I'd put together a bilingual PowerPoint presentation so they could see in English what I'm saying, and they could also read it in Russian. And I also had some colleagues who helped translate the more difficult parts.
Oh, fun.
For in order for me to function in Russia, I reported to Moscow, we went to St. Petersburg with my family, and then they went home, and then I went to Moscow, reported to the State Department, and then I took the train as part of my research, the Trans-Siberian Express, which I didn't know was all electric. It was a real eye-opener to it. And as I went across Russia into Siberia through the Urals, all the way to Irkutsk, past Novosibirsk, I started to refine the Russian I had been learning with the people on the train. And at Irkutsk, I went to Pribaikalsky National Park, which is where Lake Baikal was, and did my research on the astronomical neutrino. I don't want to get into too much detail there, but what they were doing astronomically there.
Oh, fun.
And that was part of my research. And but it turns out here in Little Arnold, California, a man down the road from me was a retired engineer, but when he was in the U.S. Air Force, he was at a listening station in Eastern Europe, and he spoke and listened for Russian communication.
Oh.
And when I told him I was going to go to Russia, he goes, do you want some help learning the language?
Wow.
And I said, I would love it. So I had 6 months of preparation, and I refused to learn Russia by transliteration, that is, using the Arabic numerals to spell out what the word sounds like. So I immediately learned the Cyrillic alphabet.
Wow.
Every day I'd get up in the morning and I'd write it out, just until it became rote. And I would say it, you know, and then I would count, you know, Dean Tatiri, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then I would go and have lessons at his house. By the time I went to Russia, I could read anything, I could say anything. I sure as heck didn't know what everything meant.
Wow.
Because I could say the words and I could, you know, and I could read the words.
Right.
But I didn't often know what the words were.
Is it and a I difficult, it, did you find it difficult language to learn?
I did find it difficult. Mm. Partly because of, I think, age, but I didn't let that stop me.
Yeah.
You know, it's getting harder, but I'm a real bulldog when it comes to learning things and being
nice.
Determined.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to embarrass the United States.
Right.
And I wanted to be respectful of the people whose country I was going to.
Nice.
And it's like when I went to France, I'd learned some French so I could get by. And I remember being in a little hotel, and the people in front of me were Americans. And they're saying, well, why don't you have a room? And da-da-da-da-da. And I thought, well, my chances are gone if there's not a room for them. And I came up and I said, you know, bonjour, je m'appelle Nancy, comment allez-vous? And I'm struggling through my friend, and pretty soon the person starts laughing at me, and in perfect English, which he never spoke to the people in front of me, says, yes, we have room for you. Yes, we do. Because I tried.
Yeah. Nice.
You know?
Nice.
And so the other people who are being ugly Americans forget about it.
Mm.
So because I was trying. But anyway, so here I come to wonderful Russia, I took the train across, and I would be able to say, I would say it, and I would ask this lady who she was, I think it was like 75 years old, was my cabin mate at one time, and she'd say what the word for horse was, and I would say the word horse, and she'd laugh, and then I'd pronounce it better, and we name all the things, and we would dacha, and we would talk about this and that, the other thing, and I saw this one sign, and it was all in Cyrillic, and I'm making the words out, and it's going, supermarket. It's spelled out in Russian Cyrillic, but it still says supermarket.
Hmm.
Supermarket is supermarket in English and in Russian.
Nice. Okay. That's easy.
So, by the time I left Russia, I was interviewed by a local reporter, and I did fine. And she says, you know what? From the time I first met you to now, your accent's gotten really good.
Wow.
I said, well, thank you. The problem is when I came back to the United States, I was helping a family who didn't speak English, and they were Hispanic, with the chains on their cars, and I was saying, and I was mixing my languages up because I could speak Spanish. So I slowly let my Russian go. If somebody speaks it to me, I can get the gist of it, and I can say some things back, but it's after 10 years, it's pretty much gone.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think if I took a refresher, it would come back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I haven't used it. But I did really well, and I had people who helped me that were wonderful there, and I had... I was down when we were in Novosibirsk, which is the capital of Siberia, which they call it there. You go south, and I was in a Four Corners area, which is the Four Corners, not very far where I was in the Altai Republic, is the border to China, Kazakhstan, and Mongolia.
Hmm.
And so that I was sort of in the Four Corners. So representing students in my class and people on campus and people in the Altai Republic, it's like saying California, people in the Altai, were real mix, maybe only 24% to 40% Slavic Russians, which you would say, you know, blonde hair, blue eye kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a lot of people who looked Asian, who looked Mongoloid,
mm-hmm.
who were from Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. All of these have Asian appearances to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so my students were a real mix. And then you had a third group, and these were the indigenous people of Altai.
Oh, wow.
And unlike the United States, who took their indigenous people and put them on reservations, the Russians never did that.
Hmm.
And so the indigenous people of the Altai, and there were five different, I don't want to call them tribes because they don't call themselves tribes, but I'll call them groupings,
mm-hmm.
live on their land and have created national park areas, and they administer them themselves.
Oh, wow.
And so, and this is one of the things I studied, Zaponics and Zapovedniks. And so, for instance, in this one I went to, the archaeologist who was an indigenous person in Altai, she took me up and we saw these great petroglyphs. And she, we, up here where it's really, really high, they have snow leopards and montals and all these other animals. And that's the closed area. Nobody gets to go there without permission.
Hmm.
In the middle areas, in the mixed conifer forest with the taiga and the tamarisks and things like that, she goes, local indigenous people can go up and cut so many cords of wood a year, but nobody who's not indigenous can do that.
Got it.
And then down on the lower part is a multiple use area for almost everybody to go to with a fee and explore, and they can go on the river, the Katoon River, and all this kind of stuff, and they pay a fee. So they have it all worked out. It's I met all these people, and it was just wonderful. And the Russians also have these areas, Zapovedniks. Some of them are three times the size of Yellowstone National Park.
Wow.
Nobody goes in except for rangers and researchers and poachers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're not open to the public. Just, and if you're in Russia and you're told you can't do something, you don't do it.
Right.
And it is a different country. It is a different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
The people, to me, are much like the Soviet-era buildings, very stark on the outside, but the inside, they're warm and wonderful. So first, you know, when you're walking down the street, the two streets of Gorno-Altaysk, because once you leave the main drag, it's all Siberian houses and cottages with a real nice wooden filigree on them, but everything's dirt. Dirt floors, dirt roadways, community water spigots. My students, I went to have dinner at some of my students' house, and, you know, you walk down the lane, and it's all dirt, and there's one of my students, Valia again, she had a dog, little dog named Leonardo, and the chain on the dog must have been, weighed 40 pounds, and this dog probably only weighed 40 pounds. And I thought, what's going on here? And I started to walk up, and the dog just ran at me and barked and barked and barked. She goes, oh, Doc and Nancy, don't go near to Leonardo. If he doesn't know you, he will kill you. And I could believe that.
Wow.
And her father had passed away a few years before. And within a week of him passing away, people had broken into their tool shed and taken all of their tools.
Wow.
So in order to survive, this is survival mode, they got Leonardo, who was in front of the kitchen garden entrance. I mean, they would grow their crops on their property and take them down underground to the kitchen garden after they made everything. And you went inside, and there was a living room and a bedroom, and her mother lived in the bedroom, and she lived in the living room, and she had a computer, but it was all very different, which you would consider a university student having.
Yeah,
but she was smart, and she was good, and we're still in contact, and she's married with a little baby boy.
No fun.
It's wonderful, Nikolai.
Hmm.
But it's when I ask the people in my different classes, I said, if you wanted to identify yourself as an Altai person, like a Californian, or as a Russian, what would you say? All the Slavic people, in appearance, said were Russians. The indigenous people and the Asian-looking people all said we are Altai. So it's a really interesting thing. And a lot of stuff was done that probably shouldn't have been done, and it's not my place to say, you know, under the table type dealings and things like that. But it is not the United States. They don't think the same patterns as we do as what is right and what is wrong. To give you an example without naming names, there was a professor of mine who one day was giving a USB stick to a student and then took some money. And I said, oh, what's that for? She goes, oh, I just took their English test for them. I said, excuse me? She goes, well, they would never pass their English test, and we could use the extra money. And I said, how long does it go on? She goes, everywhere.
Wow.
And this was a professor.
Huh.
So when I went to Star City, which is the Yuri Gagarin Cosmonaut Center, and had a tour there, which was part of my exploration of the astronomy there, it was amazing. But when I went in and saw how old everything was, the centrifuge chamber and putting things together and the glues they were using, I thought, my goodness, the United States are sending people up in these very old machines by people who may not be 100% trained. You know, it was a little scary. A little scary. But on the other hand, they were wonderful people. And if you became your friend, it is not at all Russian to give hugs in public. I'd be walking down the street, and my students would go, Doc Nancy, Doc Nancy, and they knew I was a hugger, so they'd give me hugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I made a little influence. And nothing where I lived was paid. There were no credit cards. Everything was cash.
Hmm.
So for me to pay my rent every month, which I did do, I would go with a male colleague to the bank and pull out, you know, 10,000 rubles,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then I would go and give it to the landlord.
To pay
and
rent.
And I would take that person with me
uh-huh.
so that I wouldn't be robbed.
Got it.
Another fun thing is I got there when it was T-shirt weather in August, and I left in December.
Hmm.
And it was beautiful. It was just gorgeous and stuff, but it became Siberia, and there, you know, wind would blow sideways, and women pull sleds because wheeled vehicles do not work on ice and snow. And when you're walking with colleagues, female colleagues, you always link arm in arm in the wintertime.
Hmm.
And I said, "What's that for?" She goes, "In case we slip, we can help each other." And you never step on a manhole in Russia. And since coming back, I've never stepped on a manhole in America because they're unreliably replaced. And
ooh.
More than one person has gone through a manhole.
Hmm.
So it was just fascinating, fascinating experience. And I went and learned about MCHES, which is their emergency services, and, you know, went and checked out their fire engine and exchanged T-shirts and their ambulance
cool.
people and how it all worked. And the classes were wonderful, and we had chai, which is a tea, at the very end as a celebration, and gave them their certificates of completion, and there were cries and tears, and students knitted me scarves, and I gave out presents, and Hershey's chocolate is a great present. I took Hershey's chocolate throughout Siberia, let me tell you.
Hmm.
It was wonderful.
Nice.
I went up to Lietsky Lake one time and met the keeper of the lake, and what did he have on the side of his building but a picture of Einstein with his tongue stuck out,
hmm.
you know? So it's really, really universal.
Huh.
So I had a wonderful time with my Fulbright, and then I came back, and since that time I've just, you know, been doing seminars and teaching, going to Ireland when I can to visit family, went to Vienna to do some research on giant sequoia name origins, and traveled to Cancun and Europe, and I just got back before COVID from Patagonia, got to go see Puma down there in the Andes and document them. I'm looking for opportunities, and I have the hobby of drawing and exploring, and I still go.
So now that looks like travel restrictions will be decreasing as the COVID pandemic seems to be decreasing somewhat, what are you looking forward to traveling in the future?
In the United States.
Where?
I sold my van. I'm getting a van that's getting made into another one. I want to go to a baseball game in every baseball park and visit the areas around that. But again, I will go when it's safe for us to go to other countries without being a burden to other countries.
Yeah.
I am very aware that we are very lucky in America to have vaccinations and to have
yes.
at least half of our population vaccinated.
Mm.
I have friends next week who are going to Tanzania, which I am blown away by, because of the 1 billion people in Africa, I know only 600,000 have been vaccinated.
Yeah.
In addition to that, there's a lot of unrest, especially in East Africa, behind because of Islamic from Somalia to Kenya to Tanzania.
Hmm.
And they said, well, they'll protect me. And I said, when I was in Egypt, when I went back to Egypt with Semester at Sea, there hadn't been a Semester at Sea program there for 7 years because the Semester at Sea school group had been gunned down.
Oh, wow.
And so when we went back, they wanted tourism to happen again.
Right.
So if we'd gotten gunned down or bombed or something, that wasn't going to happen. I had a personal bodyguard. We had police escorts everywhere we went, from the pyramids to, you know, the Socorro to
mm-hmm.
Luxor and everything. And we had motorcycles that went ahead of us and stopped the intersections so that we would never be a stopped target.
Wow.
We would just keep on going.
Hmm.
So I know what good protection is like, and I know that when you're on a safari somewhere, that's not the way it is. So
that is
putting yourself at risk, and I don't want to overburden another country. I would love to go explore the archaeology with my husband of Scotland.
Oh, wow.
In the future. You know, go out to the Hebrides and Skye and those islands
yeah.
and stuff. That is something we're looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think before I leave you, one of the things we talked about is on being a ranger.
Yeah.
And you know what? It was something as a child that I thought was beyond my ability because I didn't know what it took to be a ranger. And then when I graduated with a degree in biology and found out that I had skills and maybe I could do this, you have to go in, I think, with open eyes and knowing that if you're not going to be in a civilized area unless you're in an urban park like the Arizona Memorial or Gateway in New York or Wall Street or Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthplace, that of the over 420 national park areas now, quite a few of them are urban. We have the crown jewels that everybody talks about, which are these great, big, magnificent natural parks. And then you've got other parks like Oregon Pipe Cactus or Big Bend or, you know, Rainier or Olympic that are also beautiful parks, but without the infrastructure of an urban park. So when you go to work to one of these places, you've got to know you may not have a cell tower.
Mm-hmm.
You may not have the ability to have high-speed internet. Your grocery store, like when we were at Death Valley, may be 3 hours away, either in Las Vegas or in Lone Pine. And so it is a mindset that when we finally retired, we knew, hey, we don't have to shop for, you know, a month.
Right,
we
right.
got a grocery store 2 hours away. And you don't make a lot of money working for the government. And you what's the trade-off? Here I am in a national park, Sequoia, Grand Canyon, Everglades, the Hawaiian Islands, wherever I was, and said, I'm being paid to tell people how wonderful these places are. And these people are saving their hard-earned money and their vacation time to come and visit it for a short amount of time.
Right.
I mean, who really is the winner here? I thought I was the winner here.
Yeah.
So we used to say we got played in sunrises and sunsets because we weren't getting money.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we would get, it was just wonderful, the camaraderie, the friendships I still have, the places I got to open my door and see a sunset over the Tokopah Tower, or sunrise, excuse me, because it's to the east over Tokopah Tower, or sunset over the Grand Canyon. I remember coming back from an astronomy talk over at Mather Point and walking along the rim trail with Kent and knowing to look in the sky at just the right time when the Iridium satellite flashed bright gold in the sky and then disappeared within seconds.
Cool.
They don't exist anymore, but you would not have been able to see that in a city.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To be able to go out to West Rim and to see the condors overhead. I mean, this is what, to use an expression, floats my boat. This is what makes me alive and makes life worthwhile to me.
Hmm.
So if you're going to go into being a ranger, you have to decide what kind of ranger you're going to be, urban or rural. And if it's rural, can you put up with the seas? If it's urban, I had a friend of mine who worked at Alcatraz. She lived in Palo Alto.
Hmm.
She drove to the train station. She took the train to San Francisco and got off the train and got on a boat and went to Alcatraz all in uniform.
Wow.
Gave her walks, talks, and programs and came all the way back.
Hmm.
It's a national park area.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't realize that.
Right.
But that is not Grand Canyon. That is not the Grand Tetons.
Right.
But it is still representative of the stuff that makes America the most wonderful place on the planet by preserving these natural and important historical areas, I think.
Right. Absolutely. It's our American heritage, as they say.
And then, you know, if you go in and decide, this is not for me, be able to walk through another door. You know, if you're dissatisfied, figure out what it is, and then you fix it, because one of the things that's going to happen is there's very few champions in the national parks. There's plenty of mentors, but there's nobody going to walk up to you and say, you are superintendent material. We're going to put you on a fast track to superintendency. It doesn't work that way. You have to make your own way. You look for openings in a park that you want to work in, knowing that if you don't get another opening after that, you're at the park for the next 15 years, maybe, 10 years. So if you apply to Death Valley, you might ever get out of Death Valley till you retire. So you have to think things through. And, you know, you start off in fee collection. You know, I started off as a GS3 firefighter for the Forest Service.
Right.
I wasn't going to be a GS3 firefighter the rest of my life. Where was I going to go next? I became a naturalist and became an EMT. Oh, I became a paramedic. You know, I gave walks and I helped people. Oh, then I really enjoyed rescue. So then I transitioned from naturalist to being a protection ranger, and then I loved being a naturalist, so when I retired, I went back 3 years and became a naturalist at Sequoia National Park.
Hmm.
I did that because I did that.
Right.
I found my path and my pattern. And so that's what you have to think about in your life. Look for doors that can open, and you have to be the one that opens them, to be honest with you.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. But it was a great career, and I still love national parks, and I just downloaded the NPS app onto my phone just 2 days ago.
It's cool.
A new app. It's free, and you can download stuff, so you can use it while you're in the park, and you don't need Wi-Fi.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, an interpretive tool
yeah.
to take with.
But I have to say that being at the Grand Canyon for a total of 18 years, because I was there at a time after we retired, before Kent retired, was longer than we thought we would be there.
Hmm.
But Kent's career was such that there aren't too many National Park Service fire chiefs.
Right.
And by the time a job opened at Yellowstone, which was his heart park, to be the fire chief there, they actually asked him if he wanted to apply because he had a good reputation. And we both talked about it and said, you know what, maybe 20 years ago, but do we want to live where it's 20 below half the year and shovel snow all the time? And he decided that's not what he wanted to do at this stage in his life.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you always
interesting.
Look and you hope, yeah.
You know, what I did want to ask you, one of the things that I think about is a place like Albright Training Center.
Oh, yeah.
Or the Mather Harper's Training
Ferry.
Center, Harper's Ferry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where people are given opportunities within the agency to advance their career or learn, take advance some advanced training.
Yeah, and part of that isn't offered, some of it is required. For instance, if you became a new permanent naturalist, and it's your first time being a naturalist, you are required to go to interpretive 1 and 2 training.
Okay.
Learn how to build goals, things, and objectives, and all that kind of stuff. When there's also available to you supervisory training. There's if you are in the protection division, you can go to firefighter 1 and 2, and then later officer. And engineer training, not necessarily at Albright, but they are offered in the National Park Service. So
yeah.
Always training. In fact, my friend Chuck Waller worked there for a while. So did Richard Olden, worked at Harp, and he trained the new interpreters. So biologists come in, people have a degree in biology or history or whatever it is, and they've got a fountain of information. How do I get it to people? And so that's where the term interpretation is. How do I take it and explain it to you in a manner that makes sense so that you will love it enough, appreciate it, love it, and protect it, which is the goal.
And I always looked at those places as well, where the employees there would look for, well, certainly would encourage NPS employees that had come for the training to further their career.
Yes. Yes, it's under two circumstances. Some of it is required, and some of it is if you wanted to advance in your training and you wanted to become a teacher like Richard Ullman. He wanted to teach interpretation, not just offer it to the public.
Got it.
Then he'd have to go to class there. In order for him to do that, he'd have to apply to be accepted into that class. It is not a given.
I see.
And then your supervisor would have to give you the time off to do it. Do we have the money to backfill? Do we have this to do that? Is somebody going to pay you to go? I pay you right now to be a naturalist to give walks and talks. I don't pay you to go learn.
Right.
So is there money that you're going to get to do that?
Huh.
So a lot of times there's opportunities, but if it doesn't benefit your job description right now, you may not get to go.
I see. So it's very much self-driven that way.
I think so, as well as you always look for scholarship opportunities. When I came into the National Park Service as a permanent, you'd have to have become a permanent with the National Park Service. I believe I told the story, but I became a paramedic for the Department of the Army at Fort Ord.
Right, you did.
And I became I had my status.
Yes.
After that, I could apply for any permanent job there, and so it was. Now they've got all kinds of ways, because it seemed wrong here you could have a naturalist who had done a great job. A friend of mine who was a naturalist at Sequoia National Park for 16 years was the lead naturalist, but she didn't have status. So every time the job just above her opened up, she was ineligible to apply for it, even though she knew how to do the job because she'd acted in it and all that
wow.
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So she went one winter because she was a seasonal and worked for the USGS and,
wow.
US, and to get her status.
Status.
She just had to work for the government. And then the next time the job opened, she applied and she got it.
God.
Now, instead of having to jump through all these hoops, because there was a time when people would go to work at the National Parks Air Force area at the Statue of Liberty,
mm-hmm.
and they would work there for a week and then quit. Well, they'd have their status, though. And so now they made contracts saying, you're going to stay with us a year. If you quit early, you're going to be blackballed, and nobody in the National Park Service will hire you.
Right.
So now there's programs to not circumvent it, but add to this golden key. If you have a master's degree, there's a program for getting you in. If you have a biologist studying something in particular, you might be able to get into the research area of the science center more easily than applying through all this other stuff. So I'm not privy to all the ways that you become a permanent now,
mm-hmm.
but there are more avenues than there were when I first started.
Nice.
To get around that.
Yeah.
Not get around it, to add to it. Yeah. And let's see what else. And
I think maybe we'll wrap this up, but I am going to ask
okay.
you this. 50 years from now, somebody's going to listen to this interview. We're long gone. What would you like to tell that ranger or that person interested in the Park Service 50 years from now?
It's a great question, Tom. And if I could think of one thing that just popped in my head is don't lose sight of the mission of why the park is there and why you are there representing the park.
Nice.
Don't lose sight of it at all. And there was a time when there was a different Secretary of the Interior. His name was Watt, and he was part of the Reagan administration. And he wanted to allow hunting in national parks, and he wanted to build cog railways and turn them into all kinds of things that would lose what they were. In fact, to show how different his mission was, he wanted to reverse the bison on the patch to show he was going in another direction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was a really difficult time for the Park Service because the mission statement is, quote, to protect and preserve and provide for the enjoyment for present and future generations.
Mm-hmm.
So to protect and preserve, we've got it. For a long time, we protected individual trees from fire. Now we know we have to protect the processes of nature and let fire in.
Mm-hmm.
Provide for the enjoyment, well, that gives them access, but that's open to interpretation. Enjoyment might be a carousel ride in downtown. Why do we have golf courses in Yosemite National Park? You know, these kinds of stuff. So it's all open to interpretation. So I would go back to, you know, the Organic Act of,
mm-hmm.
you know, 1918, and why were they set aside in the first place, and save the parks and the processes of nature.
In such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. And that
yes.
unimpaired language is so wonderful.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
Well, Nancy Melody Meekum, thank you so very, very much for this really incredible interview series. I'm very grateful for your taking the time to do this with the Grand Canyon Historical Society. And I think with that, we will conclude this interview.
Tom Martin, thank you so much for this opportunity to go down memory lane, to look into my life and contributions, because it makes me feel good to revisit all of this. And everybody wants to feel like they made a difference and that your presence on Earth was for something, and you made me feel good, so thank you.
Well, you certainly have lived an incredible life serving others, and I am very grateful that you've done that. So thank you. With that, this will conclude part 15 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Melody Meekum. Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Nancy, thank you so very, very much.